This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Bringing Design Closer. My name is Jerry Scullion and I'm a service designer and founder of This Is HCD and CEO of thisisdoing.com, where we provide live online design and innovation classes, providing training for service designers, design researchers, product managers, user experience designers, content designers, and much, much more. Now today in the show, we have Emma Jones from Sydney. Emma is a champion of diversity in design and technology and founder and CEO of projectf.com.au, an organization that works with other organizations to help them improve their diversity internally. Did you know that 56% of women quit working in tech industry, a statistic that is double the rate of men? We speak at length about this in this episode, so it's a really good one. I was excited to speak to Emma, so let's jump straight into it. Emma Jones, a very warm welcome to Bringing Design Closer. How are you?
I'm pretty damn good, actually. Thank you. Still enjoying those warm spring days of Sydney.
I know. We've spoken about this. We've been catching up for a little bit before we started recording. But for any of the listeners who don't know who you are, I know in Sydney, you know, in Australia, people would be familiar with Emma Jones from Project F. But we're going to sort of jump into that. But tell us where you are, what you're doing, where you're currently located right now as we're speaking.
I'm on the northern beaches of Sydney, so quite near to Manly. Yeah. Anybody who's from this area would know Manly pretty well.
An awful part of the world.
Yeah, and a lot of, exactly, awful. Awful beaches. Yeah. Voted number one beach in the world or something, I don't know, possibly. Yeah. Allegedly. But yeah, I'm originally from southwest London, Fulham, as you can probably tell by my impeccable accent, which I've hung on to dearly, although the Brits will probably be going, oh, she's got that Aussie twang, which is annoying. But no, I've been living here on the northern beaches of Sydney for the last about nearly 10 years now.
Mm. Wow, 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's mad. I remember when you arrived in Australia. That's so, I remember catching up with you when you arrived. I've known Emma for a long time, for about 10 years since you arrived in Australia.
Yeah. Yeah.
We had some mutual connections at that stage and I caught up with you. And a lot of what's happened in the last 10 years, I've said this to you before, as I left Australia, has been down to you giving me a good kick up the bum.
I did.
You did. You said you need to get out there and you need to start talking about what you're talking to me about.
I did. And, I was in a cafe in Mossman, as I recall.
It was. And I sat there and I went home and I was like, I remember it was one of those meetings that I was sick that day. I was off work sick and I was nearly going to cancel on you and I didn't. And I went, and afterwards I went home and I bought my own name as a domain straight away. I went home and I was like, I bought my domain. I was like, okay, I need to do some more stuff. But so a lot of it's down to, you know, you giving me that kick. And, you know, you had small feet, but it definitely hurt kicking up the bum. it was one of those kicks that I needed. So I appreciate that. And thank you.
In fairness, you've given me a few in the years following that. So.
Quit that job. Get out of there.
Do it. Get started. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. Now look at you.
Exactly. See, so I can say thank you as well.
Emma, now you've had many kind of sort of transformations in your career, but what I'm most interested in now and what we're going to speak today is the business that you formed, and you had formed it when I was in Australia, called Project F, but it's taken on a life of its own. And I've been watching and I've been championing you from afar and, you know, celebrating and clapping the screen. And I sent you messages saying, I really am. I'm so happy to see what you're doing. And I love speaking with you and I've always loved speaking with you. And I'm really excited today to learn more about this. But for our listeners, tell us where and what Project F is and where it started.
So Project F is a social impact business with a very clear purpose to improve the representation of women in technology. And when I say representation, I mean it's kind of a retention strategy, really. The idea is very much to focus on that middle of the pipeline, if you like, rather than the top of it, because huge numbers of women in technology actually leave at the midpoint of their career. So 56% of them at the moment, which is more than double the number of men that leave Wow. technology. And that's pretty rough. And it's not to have children before the people go, oh yeah, well, women have babies. They, you don't leave an industry to have kids. You might go and come back, but yeah, from a job. But so that the purpose is to attack that, is to really approach the solving the problem in the right place. It started, I think, for me when I was working as a head of talent in a software company a few years back. And having been in people and culture for 25 odd years by then, I was like, wow, you know, it was a great job and it was a lot of fun. But I was seeing the problem firsthand that, you know, I had all these, there were just hardly any women in our technology team. And I couldn't quite understand why. And one day, one of the girls, one of the two women I think we had, came to me and said, can I talk to you? I'm really worried that I was hired as a token female. I'd heard that they didn't have women and they wanted to hire someone, and I think that's why they hired me. And she now works for Twitter, I think, over in San Francisco, but she was a junior back then and she was incredible. And the impact that she had on the team was quite incredible. Culturally, and you know, just the way they thought. They didn't used to do pair programming because the CTO didn't like pair programming, and she loved pair programming. And so she negotiated bringing it back, and it turned out the others preferred it. And, you know, and she just had such a huge impact. But the point I'm making is that that experience showed me that there were some seriously deeply embedded problems that were creating barriers to changing this, you know, to solving it.
Yeah.
And so I was seen as just being a woman in HR getting on her soapbox when I talked about it. And I recognized that if the CTO had something to say about it, then that was probably going to have a much better outcome than me trying to change it. And it was always the women trying to, you know, push this agenda. Yeah. So I set about educating myself and going off and trying to find some solutions to harness the leaders' take on this and get an understanding of where leaders stood on this. And I came across Male Champions of Change, which is tackling the same problems, but from a high sort of level policy change. You know, and having some really great results in doing that across sports and media and government and all sorts of different sectors.
Yeah.
But then when I dug into tech, I realized that tech has this ridiculous stereotype that is massively out of date, but is, you know, it's formed in the 60s. And yet we're still living with this stereotype of this nerdy guy. And hence we've created these environments for these nerdy boys with Nerf guns and ping pong tables and craft beers and, I don't know, your scooters and, yeah, you know, and arcade games and shit like that. And I just think when I started to recognize this pattern, I thought, what are we doing? Why are we just, you know, we're complaining that there aren't enough women in it, and yet all we're doing is making the problem worse every day because people just don't think about it. And there's so much data out there. I thought I've got to be able to do something about this. And that's where it started. So I
remember when you started, Male Championing Change was almost, it was at the time when I was about to leave Australia, and it was 2018. It was in around that time. But where do you think that stereotype, and you mentioned it comes from the 60s, but where does it come from, and what kind of person kind of, or like what's amplifying that? Like, so it hasn't gone away. Why hasn't it gone away, that stereotype?
If you've ever seen the film, have you seen the film Hidden Figures?
No.
Oh, It's such a good film. It's about all the women that did all the computing behind the NASA. It was all these black women back in the 50s. And so this is the thing, right? So back in the 50s, 40s and 50s, it was all women that did computing. There were no men. It was seen as a clerical kind of support job.
Wow.
If you like. So all women did it and it was manual. And then in the 60s, and they were known as the computer girls. And then in the 60s, in the sort of early mid 60s, IBM built this big first computer called the ENIAC. And so the women were then programming this machine and then started to teach, had to teach the men how to program it because there weren't enough people to do this new vocation. They didn't have a vocation. They didn't call it programming. It was a woman that actually created that term. But there was this group of the ENIAC women and they taught the guys how to use this machine and how to program it. And then what happened was IBM in 1966 got these two psychologists to create a social profile of what a programmer should look like. So they were doing all the normal cognitive tests, the mathematical, verbal reasoning, or what have you, that they had defined. And that was all good. But they wanted a social profile so they could cast wider and really go out and find the right sort of profile of person to hire for these roles. And these two guys, you can still find it if you Google it, they created this report based on their research and findings that said that the ideal programmer is a socially inept man who likes maths and puzzles but doesn't really like people. I am paraphrasing, you understand, but that's, in a nutshell, that's what they came up with. I'm not exaggerating.
That stuck.
Yeah, it stuck. So there was born this stereotype that we now see today. So then they went out, obviously, and hired against this social profile. So before long, the environment of programming was overrepresented by this geeky man who's socially inept guy. And so from the outside looking in, you'd say, well, that's obviously what it requires. So it was kind of a self-perpetuating situation. Then in the early 80s, when video games came out, if you go back and look at the marketing of video games, it was almost exclusively marketed to boys. So there was that. And then the personal computer that followed after that, the PC, was marketed to affluent men who, for something to sort of toy with and tinker with and, what have you. But by this time, women were just, they'd self-selected out. They could see, as far as they were concerned, that tech was not a place for them, for women.
You can't be what you can't see.
Yes, exactly. And then you shoot forward from, what we're living with is that legacy where you've now got a very male-dominated environment catering to a certain demographic. And if girls now look at a career opportunity or career choices, who can they see? What do they look up and see? Boys can see Elon Musk, Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg. It goes on. There's a big list of all the people that we think of automatically in household names. And boys see that and go, okay, well, that's a really obvious choice for me. But girls don't see that. And that's why until we change that, the leadership end of the scale, if we can effect some change there, that will in turn have an impact on the top of funnel pipeline. Because there's always the complaint that, there's not enough women going into tech. And you have to just stop and go, why aren't they going in? Instead of just complaining about the fact they're not going into it, you have to look at the reasons why.
And why aren't they at the moment? So let's talk about representation is one thing. But why are they still, or are they still, has it changed in the last 5-10 years?
No, not dramatically. So there's a few reasons why. One of them is what we've just talked about. So they don't, again, they generally just don't see themselves. If they think of a career, they don't think, I'm going to be the next Steve Jobs or Bill Gates or whatever. That's just not, there are no role models or hardly any role models. And so there is that issue. Another issue is that they're not being nurtured into those careers. So, when it comes to the education part of it, they're not getting that same nurturing that boys do, that, the AI and robotics classes and what have you, again, they appeal to the boys and they're designed to appeal to the boys.
Yeah.
And when you look at university, that, you know, here in Australia, we've got, I'm not sure what it's like over in the UK now, but I can't imagine it's too much better.
Or Ireland.
Or Ireland.
Go ahead.
The Australian, we have about an average of 16% of the computer science degrees are taken by women. And
wow, okay.
That's across Australia. There was a piece of research that was done that had a massive impact, which I thought was really interesting, because this is another reason, is that the computer science degrees are incredibly competitive. The way that they are designed or run or whatever, they always have been. So it's about being the best coder. So the culture of that degree is highly competitive amongst the people doing it. And that doesn't appeal to women. So what they found when they did some research on this, I think it was either the UTS, University of Technology Sydney, or the University of Sydney, they had stayed at, I think they were 15, they went from 15% to 16% in 10 years of trying to change it. As in their words, not mine, we were just trying to put lipstick on a pig, is what they said, trying to make it look more attractive. And then they engaged a bunch of people outside of the academia to help them with this. One of which, I know, was Sally Ann Williams, who was at Google for years working on the STEM side of things for them. And what this research showed up was that, in fact, women, when they take a highly technical degree course, they want to marry that with the ability to solve a real world problem. And that's not what this degree is doing. And so they changed it. They made it a 4-year degree with a 3-year exit point. And they said it's two majors. So it becomes a double degree. So you have computer science and either whether it's UI or psychology or whatever. And they went from 17% to 29% in 1 year.
Whoa, okay.
So that was huge.
Yeah.
Just with that kind of, you know, different approach to, you know, the research and thinking, okay, let's look at where women are well represented and look at those degrees and let's combine them. Yeah. And give people, the women, the opportunity to do both. So it's not that they don't want to do computer science. They just don't want to go into this competitive environment where it's about being the best coder. They actually want to use what they're learning and apply it.
Yeah.
You know, so that was the secret.
Education's got a huge role to play in this. And it's in Ireland in particular, like, it's something that I'm deeply passionate about, attracting people into design, but also everyone. Like, just attracting people into design from schools. So design is seen as a still a creative thing. It's still like art. If you're good in art in school, you might go to art college where design lives. So you're kind of watering down the potential there of having great designers coming out. Because, and then there's the other problem that, you know, design generally is overrepresented by males and by men. It's a bigger problem. So I can deeply relate to some of the stuff that you're talking about there and the role that academia has to play in helping shape those outcomes. It's a bigger problem.
You know, you're asking, you know, so why aren't there more women in tech? And the other, you know, one of the biggest things, what we've just talked about is, you know, them being, women being attracted to tech as a career. But one of the biggest problems is keeping them in tech. So they're not in senior roles.
No. But what I was going to say is when they're welcomed into these cultures, the cultures are very male dominated, and they're actually, the behaviors and rituals are very male centric.
They are.
And or men centric, should I say. And from just being in there, like, it's, I've worked in those organizations. I don't find it comfortable myself. And I can kind of speak and, you know, walk the walk and, you know, do the talk and all that kind of stuff that you say, but it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel inclusive.
They're like frat houses, a lot of them, you know.
Very
it's all
so.
And that's why I say
it's Friday.
Exactly. They're designed for a specific demographic. You just walk into a tech company and, you know, you're in a tech company. You know, you're in a, even if you're in a, I don't know, financial services company, and you walk around the building and it's all very lovely, and marketing has got lots of plants and pictures and soft furnishings, and, you know, HR is very very nice too. And then you go into the tech team, into the engineering team, and it's not as nice. It's designed around a certain demographic. I did a whole talk on this at Web Directions last year, and you know, went through the whole historic thing and had lots of pictures of these environments, and then the pictures of, you know, if you look at the design, the people who are designing these co-working spaces now, they've, you know, they've cleverly looked at the fact that I think it's something like 44% of these co-working spaces are populated by women. And so they've designed them to appeal to women as well as men. And so, I mean, I work at Fishburners, which is in the Sydney Startup Hub, where all the other startups are, and they're all co-working spaces, and they've got lots of sofas and cushions and rugs and artwork and plants and, you know, and it's really quite a lovely place to work. And that's by design. It's not just happened, it's by design, as are the tech spaces. They are what they are by design.
So tell us, Project F, what do you do for these businesses? So say, what does a client, a good client, look like for Project F initially? Well, how do you identify them?
It's a bit like good old Simon Sinek says, that you have to find people who love what you love. Right, so a good company for Project F would be a company that cares, honestly, cares about diversity and inclusion. They want to create an environment where everyone can thrive. And they recognize that not only is it good for their people, but it's also good for their business.
How are you identifying those? Like, how do you suss out that? Because there's a case for websites there that kind of go, we've got a purpose, and you know, they say these things, but really when you scratch beneath the surface, there's not that much difference.
Correct. So they are attracted by what we do because we talk very openly about trying to remove the lip service from diversity and inclusion and get rid of the smoke and mirrors. So when the companies where their HR teams are focused very much on what I call window dressing, so, you know, creating something that looks good, but, you know, it's a bit like if your budget for D&I, or diversity and inclusion, is less than your, I think it was Aubrey Blanche who said this recently, if your budget for D&I is less than your budget for swag or snacks or whatever, then that's probably not a company that we're going to be, that are going to be too interested in working with us.
Just to stop you there, what typically, you know, what's the ratio of investment into D&I from a tech company in relation to, say, something like training?
Minimal. It'll be tiny by comparison. For the most part, it'll be tiny by comparison. You know, a company who are spending, a lot of them don't even have budget for D&I. So they'll have a budget for learning and development that might be $100,000 a year, but they might have, they'll have no budget assigned to diversity and inclusion. So they'll have to find, the conversations I have mostly, they have to find where they can put the budget. They'll often ask me, what's the cost? And so they can think about which budget they can assign it to. And it's either the tech budget or it's the people and culture budget. And can they put it onto learning and development?
Yeah.
It's not a learning program, but, or, you know, some other form of change.
So typically, how are they managing D&I? Like, so what's the current state that you're looking at when you go into those organizations? How do they manage that?
They tend to, quite often, it's diversity and inclusion is managed on an overarching, you know, it's one thing. Mm. It's not by department. So for Project F, we work with any, it was sector agnostic, it doesn't matter what type of company it is. Any company that has a technology team or a, you know, a digital capability will have a tech team, and it's likely to have a minority. The women will be a minority in that team. So companies generally will talk about the diversity as a whole. So they'll say, okay, we're 50-50. And so this is when I'm talking about gender diversity as opposed to cultural or any other. And there are many types. So they'll have an overall, so they'll talk about cultural diversity at the same time as gender diversity and neurodiversity and all the other things. And they'll talk about all the things they do to cater for those things. So they may have great access for, they might have you know, really good access for people with disabilities. They may have, you know, made their building very accessible. They may have made their products very accessible. You know, they may have a lot of great cultural initiatives and, you know, cater for different cultural identities, and maybe LGBTQI is their focus, and they've got 50-50 in terms of gender split, etc. So they'll look at it as an overall thing, which is not a bad thing. But the problem we have with technology, and this is why I focus very much, you know, it's a laser focus on just technology, is that technology is the future of our world, right? And we have a very diverse world, and currently the technology products and services are being built by pretty much one demographic, yeah, and, you know, a homogenous group of people, and, you know, half the population are women. So yeah, even in a company where they've got 50-50, if you ask them what's the representation or what's the gender split in your technology team, the chance is likely to be around 15%, anywhere, yeah, between, you know, 10, or from what I see, anything between 8 and about 22 would be enough, you know, somewhere in that, yeah, in that range, which means that the women in those teams will be quite isolated.
And the career paths are probably quite restricted as well in terms of progression.
They'll be restricted by a number of reasons that sit within the systems and processes of an organization. Mm. That's the bit that we focus on, is solving that problem. Yeah. So most companies, again, they kind of don't want you to see the problem child. And the companies that we align to are the ones that actually want to tackle the problem child. They're not afraid to say, we're not perfect. We have a problem here and we don't know how to solve it.
You've mentioned a couple of clients that you're currently working with. Are you okay to talk about some of them?
Sure. I mean, I talk about Canva because they're a good example, because they're an early adopter, and, you know, so they were the first client that we actually brought onto the program.
Huge Australian success story.
Yeah.
You know, incredible business.
Incredible. And they've got a female, one of the founders is a woman. So that's Melanie Perkins, very young and driven and hugely successful. She's only in her early 30s now. And the company's valued at $5 billion or something recently. It's a hell of a success story.
Yeah.
But as with any other company, as much as they've got a great culture and they're known for their culture and a great set of products, they have the same problem as everybody else.
Tell us what problems they came to you with.
Well, the fact that they were about 16% women in their technology teams, and they didn't like it, and they didn't know how to fix it. They were growing at such a rate that they had to take, and they're very, very high bar in terms of their recruiting processes and the types of people that they're hiring in the tech teams. And the engine is a very engineering led culture as well. So they would be competing with the likes of Google and Atlassian and Amazon Web Services and so on for talent. But they're growing at such a rate that it was just getting worse. And they wanted to get a handle on this. How do we fix this? They know it's not just about branding, right? It's not just about saying, oh, we're great. You know, they actually had to figure out what were the right things to focus on. And so that's where I'd started having conversations with them, because I knew them quite well generally from having worked in this ecosystem and my Men Championing Change meetup group. So I knew the engineering leaders in there relatively well anyway. So they knew what we were doing and said, can you come and talk to us about it? And when I told them what it was, that what the program was, they were like, we have to do this. This is exactly what we need, because we need to be able to look at, we have so many different initiatives. We're trying to, you know, grow the foundations to support the rapid growth of this organization. And we care about the people to the degree that we need to know what it is that we don't know.
Yeah.
So what are we not doing? Should we be focusing on? So we got them on the program late last year, and they've been an absolute dream, actually. They're so on board with it and so keen and eager to fix the problems. And we have regular progress updates and calls with the heads of technology and the people who are involved as a steering group on the program, and they're starting to see some results now. So they shared recently with me some of the results of the conversion rate. So the attraction and conversion is already up. which is a really promising sign. And later on, and it will take a while, it's always going to be a slow burn, but later on they'll start to see the retention improving as well. So it was just a case of doing a deep dive and looking at what they're doing, doing the proper analysis that was required to be able to show them the areas they need to, the highest impact areas. And none of them are quick wins, or very few of them are quick wins. It's all going to be stuff that will take time.
So you provide, you conduct an audit and you provide a framework, is it, for them to follow?
It's a roadmap, really, with some milestones. Okay. So we provide a detailed roadmap that shows the areas of highest impact and why, you know, the data that it's based on. And then we agree with them what the milestones are from there, so they can break it down into this sort of size of pieces of work and projects that can come out of this that will fit in with their overall, you know, the other objectives that they're working on as an organization. Because it's mostly, you know, it's not technology specific. It's it's about people. And of course, every other part of the business is going to benefit from the work that's done as well. It's not just that this, it'll have a more dramatic impact on technology, but every part of the business.
Can you talk to me a little bit more around those process changes? So what are the things that you're seeing that needs to change? Like, obviously, something is something like a job description being created to attract people is a simple thing.
It's a minor one. That's actually quite a minor one.
But it allows them to focus on what they're actually trying to say.
Yeah. Some places might need that more than others, and it'll be different from one company to another. But the typical things that we see that are areas of high impact will be things like leadership capability. Mm-hmm. You know, inclusive leadership is not something that is given, it's not an automatic thing that a technology leader has gained over their career. At the point at which they start becoming responsible for people, they may well not have an understanding of what inclusive leadership even means or looks like, let alone how to do it. And they're often not given the time, you know, in order to actually focus on leadership. So leadership capability is a big one, you know, learning how to manage a flexible workforce so that they can actually hire people that aren't full-time and hire a workforce that is more flexible. That's a skill set that not everybody automatically has. So putting some effort into addressing these leadership capability needs is a big one. Another one is managing performance. So performance, it's a huge area for bias to have an impact and creep in and really do some damage if it's not watertight. And, you know, that is not an easy thing to achieve. So performance review processes are often looser than they should be. And in environments, in technology environments, you often want these kind of very social groups to form, and it feels great. But the downside is that it can actually do some real damage to the ability for women to progress. And I've got to say this, because the easiest way to demonstrate this is to tell you about, or to use the example of, did you used to watch Friends?
Yeah.
Do you remember the episode where Rachel smokes?
Come on, it's 20-odd years ago. Maybe.
I'll remind you. Okay. I've seen them all a million times probably, but... The one where she smokes is where she goes for her dream job. I think it was at Ralph Lauren somewhere. And she's love it. She's on her first day and she's with her boss and they're all ideating and, you know, doing stuff in the office, and she's loving it. And then they get up and go, right, cigarette. And they all go out and they're like, you come in, Rachel. She's like, I don't smoke. So they go off. And what happens over the next few days is this keeps happening. And she keeps hearing about all these things that have these parties and these meetings and these projects, and she wasn't part of them.
I remember.
And she's hating this. So one day she walks outside to the smoking area and they go, oh, I didn't know you smoked. She goes, oh, yeah, you know, I've been. Anyway, so then she gets into the. Then that's exactly what happens, is these in and out groups that form in these very social environments. And you can see that in the data that comes out of the performance reviews, is that people are treated differently based on these groups.
Yeah.
And it's not intentional. It's completely unconscious. No one intends to do that, but it has a detrimental effect on women's ability to progress. They're not seen in the same light or the same importance as men in those organizations.
Yeah.
So it's all about just, you know, focusing on structure and how things are structured and the processes you've got in place that can remove those dangers.
Yeah. So a large part of this is a within the audit, it's a cultural understanding of the rituals and what it looks like and identifying those things and calling them out as part of the roadmap, presumably.
Yeah, it's giving, yeah, exactly. So it's giving them the clarity that they need to see what's actually happening and then giving them the tools to fix that, you know, what the clarity around what they actually need to do to change it.
So what does an engagement look like for Project F then? Is it like you do the audit and is it a 6-month thing or 6-week thing or is it a 10-year thing?
They're in it for life, really.
Yeah, I've got you. They can't get rid of you.
Well, because the idea is that, you know, what we want them to do is to stay on the journey because it's not a short-term thing. It's not like you can just plug something in and it's going to solve your problem. Cultural change of any description takes time. But in the same way as behavior change, if you're trying to change, you know, a whole sector's behavior or whatever with a design, then you're not going to expect to see results immediately. So we want them to continue to maintain the commitment. And we also want to support them through that journey as well. So I think the whole program probably, you know, from start to achieving the first set of milestones is probably anything between 8 months and a year.
Yeah.
And then next set of milestones after that depends on the company.
Yeah, absolutely.
Completely. But I suspect these things can be quite ongoing.
So you mentioned when we were speaking earlier on that you've got a startup. How did you call it? It was a startup framework.
Toolkit.
A toolkit. Talk to me about why you've done this and what's involved and what's inside that toolkit. Because you've only got 100 of them to give away, isn't it?
Well, no, we've got... So there's as many as there needs to be, but it's free to the first 100. There's two types, and it's free to the first 100 for each, which I think will be quite sufficient at the outset. So we've got two toolkits. What we want to do is to be generous to tech startups. We want them to be the future of diversity and inclusion in technology. So we want to give them the tools that they need, and even when if once those 100 are taken, it's only like $50 or something, but it's more about the commitment. So what we want to do is give every startup the opportunity and the tools they need to lay the foundations to build a gender-balanced organization. So from the ground up, so from the time they're one person to making their first handful of hires and then beyond. So but they don't develop that otherwise inevitable diversity debt that everybody else would get in technology, which is almost unavoidable otherwise. So there's two versions. One is called Pledge, which is a bit like the Pledge 1% type thing. It's asking companies to for anything, so a company between one person and 20 people. So when you're really small and you've got nothing and you're just starting and you're very ambitious, you might have a bit of funding. You might not, might be bootstrapping, whatever. But we want them to be able to, if they care about this, to say, I'm pledging to grow a gender-balanced technology business from day one. And so we give them the foundational policies they'll need, so a code of conduct, a diversity and inclusion policy, and a hiring kit, which has everything you need in it, a job template and a guide and the process kit as well. So for interviewing, the whole thing. Because I think that's what they need at that point.
Yeah.
They just don't know what they're doing or where to go or how to go about it. So we give them all that they need for that part of it. And of course, they can display the logo on their website, which is a beacon to women in tech to say, if they want to go join a startup, yeah, we have the basics. We have the stuff that shows you we're committed to this.
Yeah.
You're not going to join a boys club.
Yeah.
It also is attractive to investors as well. So they want to know that you're thinking about the long-term and sustainability and growing a gender-balanced business as well. The second one, which is, so if you're over 20 people but under 60 people, then we've got the entire toolkit, which is everything. And it's got everything you could possibly need for hiring, for growing and developing, and for the long term of running. So there's templates, there's guides, there's policies, and there's framework. So there's everything you could possibly need. So all your foundational policies, whether it's flexible working, parental, equal parental leave, diversity and inclusion, etc., and then your EVP guide, your hiring guide, and then all your inclusive leadership training, everything is in there. But it's all written with the startup in mind. So it's very simple, and you can literally put your logo on it, embed it, plug and play. So it's everything.
If people want to try and get that, where is it? projectf.com.au? Is that the website where they need to go to do
it? It is projectf.com.au. It's not actually up on there as yet, because I literally only launched it last week. It's going out through Blackbird Ventures.
Okay.
And then it's going out for other accelerators and VCs. But they can go on there and put the contact sheet. There's a, you know, contact us and just drop us a note and we'll send the overview. It will go up there in the next couple of weeks, I expect.
By the time this goes out, it'll probably be up there, hopefully. I'll drop a link to the website and to the toolkit as well in the show notes. Emma, you know I love you, and you know I love speaking with you. But if people want to do the same and they want to speak with you, what's the best way of doing it?
On the website, again, they can just go to the website and drop me a note. There's, I think there's a way to book a meeting. There's a, you know, book a meeting with me on there. And there's just a, just send me a note on the contact. In fact, I even think my phone number might be on there.
Oh, no.
But don't ring me in the middle of the night, will you?
Oh, no. No, no. I would never. I barely call anyone anyway, so it won't be from me if you do get a phone call from Ireland. But you are on Twitter. I know your Twitter handle is...
I'm on Twitter. I'm
Ms. Jones in Sydney.
Yes, Ms. Jones in Sydney. I'm on, you know, I always say you can take the girl out of London.
Yeah.
So I'm also on Instagram, LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Facebook,
I'll throw a link to all of those into the show notes as well.
Okay.
Emma, great speaking with you. I'll chat to you soon.
You too. Thank you, Jerry.
So there you have it. That's all for this episode of Bringing Design Closer. If you like this episode, feel free to visit thisishcd.com, where you can access our back catalogue of over 100 episodes, with episodes related to service design, product management, design research, and much, much more. If you're interested in design and innovation training, feel free to check out our business, thisisdoing.com, where you can join online classrooms and learn from the world's best design and innovation leaders. Join the This Is HCD newsletter, where you'll receive updates from the network. And also, if you're interested, apply to join the Slack community on thisishcd.com. Stay safe, and until next time, take care.